Ours is the heritage of Western civilization, a civilization built by adventuring men through 30 generations of trial and glory, from the Middle Ages to the 20th century.
The American Broadcasting Company proudly presents Heritage, dramatic adventures from the chronicles of 10 centuries of Western civilization.
Materials for these documentary programs are prepared in cooperation with Life magazine, based upon life's picture history of Western man, and produced in collaboration with leading scholars and educators. Today, Heritage dramatizes a murder story, a comedy, and a fable. Three stories from the famous Decameron of Boccaccio, with Charles Irving as narrator.
Six hundred years ago, the culture of Western civilization opened like a flower in radiant sunlight with the Italian Renaissance, a remarkable period in which some of the world's greatest art and literature was created. One of the golden names of that golden time was a writer, Giovanni Boccaccio, who wrote a book called The Decameron, a collection of 100 stories. The Decameron influenced Western writing and thinking for centuries, for it was one of the first literary efforts to deal with people as they are, with humor and keen insight. The prologue of The Decameron begins in the year of a great plague. The setting, Italy, in the year 1348. A terrible plague rages in the east, then spreads insidiously westward. A violent pestilence against which 14th century medicine is completely helpless. Finally, it strikes at the very heart of the fair city of Florence. Physician, no herbs or medicines are of any avail against the swelling boils, the telltale livid patches, the agony and death. So contagious is the disease that merely touching the clothing of the sick causes infection. And as the plague continues to mount in ferocity, spreading from the hovels of the poor to the palaces of the noble, a new barbarism is born. The sick lie untended, moaning and gasping in their extremity. Brother forsakes brother, husband forsakes wife, and the city is gripped by the stench of death and the frenzy of terror.
Keep away!
Pickmen shoulder the countless biers and hurry the corpses for indecent burial in vast trenches. And Florence falls into moral and physical decay. While the plague rages, a certain little group of 10 noblemen and noble women flee the dying city and take themselves to a palace 2 miles from Florence. A palace with a great courtyard, green gardens, and wells of pure, deep water. On the first day, to while away the tedium, they select a queen, and she suggests...
Let us all sit upon the grass and pass this day in telling stories.
And so each one of the 10 tells a story. So pleasant does this day prove that they do the same thing the next day, and the next for 10 days. 10 times 10, the 100 stories that make the collection which Boccaccio called the Decameron. of the stories of the Decameron are familiar to you. For Boccaccio has been copied and imitated during the past 600 years by such writers as Chaucer, Keats, Shakespeare. The Decameron has been described as a supreme delineator of character and observer of human passions. But more than that, Boccaccio believed that literature should teach some truths beneath a veil of fiction. The story of Nathan and the murderer.
La morte stesso è il dono della vita. Death itself is a gift of life.
The story begins in a green and lovely area of Italy, famed for the wealth of its noblemen. Now there is one rich old nobleman called Nathan, who lives in a great palace. He is so generous that he receives and entertains whoever enters his palace. This generosity finally reaches the ear of a young man named Mithridates, who is no less rich than Nathan, but who bitterly envies Nathan's fame for generosity.
Woe is me. When shall I attain Nathan's liberality, let alone pass it? Ay, in truth, I must remove him from the earth. And since old age does not carry him off, I must do it with my own hand. And then, after Nathan is murdered, then will I be known as the most generous man on earth.
Accordingly, Mithridates rides to Nathan's palace, arriving at nightfall. As he approaches the palace, he sees an old man, unattended, walking for diversion near a brook. Of course it is Nathan, but Mithridates does not know that.
Old man! Could you inform me where Nathan dwells?
My son, there is no one in these parts who is better able to show thee. If it pleases thee, I will take thee there.
Ah, that would be most acceptable, old man. But look you, I must not be seen nor known by Nathan.
That also will I do, since it pleases you.
Nathan takes Mithridates to the palace and orders one of the servants secretly to inform those of the house that none should reveal who he really is. Moreover, Nathan lodges him in a goodly chamber and bears him company. Finally, Mithridates turns to the old man.
Tell me, who are you?
I am an unworthy servant of Nathan, who has grown old without advancement. Albeit everyone else is mightily pleased with Nathan, I, for my part, have little cause to thank him. But who art thou, sir? What brings thee to these parts? Tell me, so I may assist you as much as lies in my power.
Mithridates hesitates. Should he reveal his plan to murder Nathan?
Will you pledge secrecy, old man?
If you wish, I so pledge.
My name is Mithridates, and I have...
He tells who he is and why he has come. At first, Nathan, hearing the young man's cruel intent to murder him, is confused. But then, with an undaunted mind, he replies...
Mithridates, your father was a noble man. You have entered on high enterprise in attempting to be liberal to all.
But what think you of my jealousy, my envy of Nathan and his virtues?
I commend it.
You commend it?
Aye. For if there were many more such as you, the world would soon be good.
Old man, thou wilt keep what I have told thee a secret.
Better than that. I will even give you useful counsel. Come, look. Thou seest from this window that coppice?
Aye.
And every morning Nathan walks through that wood all alone. And it will be an easy matter to find him and do your will.
Aye.
If you do murder Nathan, then flee at once by the road on the left hand. For though it is wilder, it is nearer your country and safer for thee.
Old man, I thank thee for thy counsel.
The following morning, Mithridates rises, and taking his bow and sword, makes for the woods, where he sees Nathan from afar, walking. He runs toward him, seizes him, and bellows,
"Nathan, Nathan, thou art dead! Now turn around so that I may look upon the face of the man who in..." "No, it cannot be. Old man, it is you. You who received me so lovingly and counseled me and advised me."
"I am Nathan."
"Oh, shame, shame. Now, Nathan, do I recognize how truly great is your liberality. You are come to give me your life because I wished it."
"Yes, my son."
"Oh, but God has opened the eyes of my understanding, which envy had closed. Take vengeance on me, the vengeance equal to my sin."
"Oh, my son, do not be ashamed of having sought to slay me so that you might become famous. The greatest emperors, the most illustrious kings have slain an infinite number of men, and burnt countries, destroyed cities to enlarge their realms and make themselves famous."
"I commend your honorable excuse, Nathan. But even more I marvel that you brought yourself to meet death and gave me the means to do it."
"I have lived 80 years, my son. I'm old and weary. You came here, desirous of my life, and I determined to give it to you as a gift and save your life as well."
"But why? Why?"
"There can be left me now only a little while longer. I would rather bestow my life as a gift, as I have my other treasures, than to have it taken from me against my will."
"Indeed, thy generosity is overwhelming."
"Take my life, Mithridates, if thou wish it. The longer I keep it, the less worth it will have. Take my life, I beseech you."
"God forbid I should. Rather would I add thereto my own life."
"Are you really willing to do that?"
"I?
To add thy years to mine? To make me take of thy good, I, who never took anything from others?"
I.
"Then thou shalt live with me, young as thou art, here in my house, and bear the name of Nathan."
Scholars tell us that Boccaccio, the master storyteller of the 14th century, moved Western literature a great stride forward, for he transformed the rudeness of old fables into stories that had a feeling for the beautiful in man's character, as in the story of Nathan. But Boccaccio was also a delightful wit. His pen was dipped in satire. He wrote with gusto and sharp humor of people and their problems of daily life. The story of King Solomon and the naughty wife.
Amore, onore, obbedienza. Senza obbedienza, dov'è l'onore? Dov'è l'amore? Love, honor, and obey. Without obedience, where is honor? Where is love?
Melissa, my friend, I'm going on a journey to Jerusalem. Will you join me?
To Jerusalem? Why, Josepho?
To seek counsel of Solomon.
Are there no wise men here in our land that we must journey so far for counsel?
Believe me, good friend, only the wisdom of Solomon himself can save me from the plight in which I find myself.
Oh? What troubles you, Josepho?
My wife.
Your wife? But she is exceedingly beautiful.
Beautiful she may be, Melisso, but she's also the most forward and perverse woman alive. Neither prayers, nor kindness, nor threats will curb her waywardness or temper her ungovernable spirits.
Josepho, your burden is indeed heavy. We will journey to Jerusalem.
And so they journey for days and nights till they come to Jerusalem. And and at length they are admitted to the presence of the king. Josepho sets forth his case.
And she is without a doubt the most forward and perverse woman alive. Now neither prayers nor blandishments avail, your majesty. And I'm sorely tried. What shall I do, O Solomon?
Get thee to Goosebridge.
Josepho, though at a loss to understand the strange counsel, was immediately removed from the king's presence, and finding Melisso outside, tells him what he had for an answer.
He said, get thee to Goosebridge.
Such silly advice. I say, get thee home.
Whereupon, the two puzzled and disappointed men set out to return home. At length, they come to a river over which there's a narrow bridge. On the bridge is a stubborn mule who sits and refuses to move. The muleteer begins to beat it and yell at it.
Move, you stubborn animal! Up!
Josepho, see that man. Here, you, stop! Stop beating that mule!
What a wretch that muleteer is! What are you doing, muleteer?
Can you not see?
But beating an animal on the head and flanks and crupper, what good is it? See, the mule does not budge. Your cruelty is to no purpose.
Why do you not manage your mule by fair means and gentle dealings? He will come quicker than if you beat him so.
Good sirs, you know your horses, but I know my mule. Leave me do with him as I will.
Melisso, the mule. He rises. He obeys. The muleteer with his beatings has won the bout.
Amazing. Beat a mule and it becomes obedient.
I never would have believed it.
Come, we must get on.
Wait. Tell me, good man. Where are we?
Sir, you are at a place called Goosebridge.
As the two men journey homeward, Josepho maintains a deep and thoughtful silence. When they arrive, travel-weary and famished, Josepho says to his wife,
Wife, prepare supper for us. We are sore famished.
You are dirty with the mud of the road.
Huh?
I will do nothing for you. There are inns on a highway. You should have eaten there.
Wife, thou art still what thou wast. But believe me, I will make thee change thy fashion.
Oh?
Melisso.
Yes, Josepho.
We shall soon see about Solomon's counsel and Goosebridge. Remember what the muleteer said when we pitied his mule.
I know my mule. Leave me do with him as I please.
Josepho looks at his wife. Her ears are small and pink, not long, black and droopy. Her flesh is fair, not dark and shaggy. Her voice is melodic, very unlike the sound of braying. But these are only surface differences.
Why do you take up that stick, Josepho?
Because of what I learned at Goosebridge. Into the chamber, woman.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
Would you strike a woman?
At Goosebridge, it was a mule who would not obey.
Oh! Me! Oh!
Finally, the door opens, and out comes Josepho.
Tomorrow, we shall see what we shall see.
So comes the morrow.
Wife, it's time to rise.
As you say, my lord.
What? The time for breakfast.
Whatever is your pleasure, Josepho.
Really? Well, and then clean the house so we may have pride in it.
How right you are. How very, very right.
I am? I am? Well. Well, well, well. What a wise man is Solomon.
Years after Boccaccio, Shakespeare wrote a play about an unmanageable wench called The Taming of the Shrew. And 300 years after that, Noah Coward, in his play Private Lives, said...
Certain women should be struck regularly, like gongs.
Boccaccio's point, however, was that a good marriage requires mutual respect, and also that a good story should be about real people and real problems. Boccaccio was one of the first writers of Western civilization to give a true reflection of the people and customs of an age. Now, let us hear a third story, one with a tolerance significant for our time. The story of the Three Rings.
Una risposta ingegnosa è spesso una risposta savia. A clever answer is often a wise answer.
There was once a Saladin of great valor who won so many victories over both Saracen and Christian kings that he became Sultan of Babylon. Now, seated in the court of this Sultan are two men, one a wise and respected rabbi, and the other a devout and learned Christian. The Sultan, who has been chatting familiarly with them on many subjects dear to him, turns and says provocatively,
"There is in my kingdom a man of such wisdom that never in his whole life has he been at a loss to answer a single question."
"But, sire, that isn't possible."
"Furthermore, this man, in answering whatever questions are put to him, has such wit and talent that never once has he been known to offend anyone."
"But, sire, that is unbelievable."
"You think so? You shall hear for yourself. We shall put him to the test. Summon to the palace Melchizedek."
Within the hour, Melchizedek is brought to the palace, and the Sultan presents him to the rabbi and the Christian, seats him familiarly by his side, and speaks.
"Melchizedek, you are a learned and honest man. It is said of you in Babylon that you can answer any question without causing offense to anyone."
"The Sultan does me too much honor."
"Nay, I merely wish to prove the truth of this to my guests. I am a Saracen. This man is a Hebrew, and the other a Christian."
"Yes, my lord."
"You, Melchizedek, are reputed to be deeply versed in the divine law. Now answer this question. Which of the three laws do you believe to be the true law? The Hebrew, the Saracen, or the Christian?"
Melchizedek is in truth a man of learning and understanding. He looks at the three men, the Hebrew, the Christian, and the Saracen. And this he knows. He cannot praise any one of the three more than the others without causing offense. Accordingly, he sharpens his wits, and there speedily occurs to him an idea.
"My lord, the question you propound is a nice one, and it behooves me, if it pleases you, to tell a little story."
"It pleases me."
"There was once a man both great and rich, who among all the precious jewels in his treasury possessed a beautiful and costly ring. To do honor to this ring, and wishing to have it descend in perpetuity to his descendants, he made a decree.
Whichever of my sons shall, at my death, be in possession of this ring by my bequest, shall be recognized as my heir, and shall be chief and head of all my properties."
"The son who received the ring passed it on to his descendants in like manner, just as his father had done. And so the ring went from father to son through many generations. But finally, It came into the hands of a man who grew old and bitterly puzzled.
I am in the greatest distress. I am old, close to death, and I must bequeath this ring to but one of my sons.
And I am but a jeweler. How can I help so great a lord?
Listen, I shall tell you. I have three sons, all goodly, virtuous, and obedient to their father. I love all three alike. All three wish the ring, and yet I cannot in my heart choose but one to be my heir.
Which of three sons? Oh, a great problem.
Therefore, I have decided thus. You, my juror, must fashion for me two other rings, so like this one, that I myself shall not be able to know which is the true ring.
Oh, but, sire, if I do...
You shall be generously paid, and I shall know what to do with the three rings.
And so it came to pass that when the old man was about to die, he secretly called his sons to him one by one, and gave each one a ring. Then the father died, and each son promptly produced his ring and claimed the inheritance and honors.
Well, Melchizedek, continue. If the rings were all exactly alike, how could the decision be made as to which was the true one?
Exactly, my lord. The decision was a difficult one to make. Now, O mighty Soldan, I sit here and gaze upon you three lords and answer the question in like manner.
Which is?
Of the three laws given of God to the three peoples, the Hebrew, the Christian, and the Saracen, each people deems itself to have God's inheritance, his true law, and his commandments. But which one really has it? Like the rings, the question is pending to this day.
Most excellently spoken, Melchizedek. Thou hast indeed answered the question with skill and learning and without causing offense to any of us. Slave, take Melchizedek to the coffers and lavish him with jewels and other gifts. He has earned them well.
And so, from the pen of a 14th century author, three stories reflecting part of the moral and cultural heritage of Western man. In the 600 years since Giovanni Boccaccio, the threads of honor, of tolerance, of love have been woven into the fabric of our history. We understand the humor, the reality, the spirit of that earlier time because they and we are linked to the great common heritage of Western civilization.
Next week, Heritage dramatizes a delightful chapter from American history, School Days. You'll hear how the Little Red Schoolhouse molded the character of a nation. Be sure to listen.
Materials for these documentary programs are prepared in cooperation with Life magazine, based on Life's picture history of Western man, and produced in collaboration with leading scholars and educators.
Heritage is produced and directed by Sherman H. Dreyer. Today's program, in association with ABC, featured Court Benson, Gregory Morton, Frank Behrens, Anita Anton, Joe DeSantis, and Maurice Tarplin. Narrator for Heritage is Charles Irving. Original music by Al Datz and Ralph Norman. The orchestra was conducted by Mr. Norman. Sound effects by Hal Johnson. Today's script by David and Judith Bublik. This is Charles Woods speaking.
This program was transcribed. This is ABC Radio Network. It's 10 o'clock at KECA AM and FM Los Angeles.